Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. Two new research centers have just opened in the province. ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, is underwriting a new center at the University of Calgary, which deals with information security. Called the Center for Information Security and Cryptography, it's a dream come true for mathematician Dr. Hugh Williams. And the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Water Research was announced at the recent Watershed Conference in Calgary. This Pan-Alberta initiative will bring together scientists from Alberta's three research universities to tackle the very real problems we have over water ecology and water usage. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You may hesitate to purchase something with a credit card over the internet, but you probably don't even think to encrypt an email message that you're sending to a colleague or a friend. But judging from the demonstration Professor Hugh Williams gave at the launch of the new ICOR Center for Information Security and Cryptography at the University of Calgary, no one's information is safe.
Largely because of the vulnerability of information that's on the internet, and just about everybody's using the internet these days. And because of that, what can happen is that even some of the most innocent information that you're sending across the internet can be used for very nefarious purposes. As we just saw in the demonstration here earlier, just my sending an email message that was picked out of the air by the coffee can that they were using, they were able to find that I was going to go away for a little while. And they knew exactly the dates that I would be away. They were then able to backtrack through and find out where my address is. And if they were thieves, they would know that I wouldn't be there at that time and that therefore it might be an easy time for them to rob me. I mean, there are many other possibilities, but that's just one very simple one.
How is it that they would just pick it out of the air, as it were?
Well, what happens is they don't pick it out of the air. What they do, they can pick the messages out because the antenna is highly directional, and because wireless technology was being used, and because the messages were not encrypted, they can get these messages through their tin can, and then there's some fairly complicated technology after the tin can, I might add, but they can still pull this stuff up. And what they're doing is they're not trying necessarily to get me. What they're trying to do is to get someone. And so they just look through, and they can scan for a period of time, and then they can go, after they've done this, back home and read all the stuff they've scanned and find out if there's anything that's interesting in there.
The University of Calgary is just opening a new center which deals with cryptography and trying to find a way to protect our secrets, as it were. What are you going to be doing?
Well, mainly we're interested in a number of things. We, of course, do research in cryptographic matters, but we also are interested in involving a wide spectrum of individuals and interests within this so that we can keep track of what the problems are and so that we can educate people, students, for example, in what they should be aware of so that they can end up being useful members of various corporations who are interested in security. This is going to increase more and more. If these corporations are not doing their own security work, they will certainly have someone who is there who makes sure that their communications are secure. And such individuals have to be well-trained and well-versed in what's going on.
What kind of research are you going to be doing?
Well, my research is mainly on the mathematical end. I'm interested in developing algorithms and researching problems that are relevant to secure communication. So I'm way off, you might say, on the left-hand side of the spectrum. But that's just the way it is. Security these days is a very, very big problem, and no one is an expert in all of it. That's why I want to have this group of people who represent as many aspects of the problem as possible.
Well, how do algorithms play into it? Give me an example.
Well, okay. Algorithms come into it in the following sense. What we want to be able to do is to assure ourselves that whatever algorithm is there to solve a particular problem takes a very, very long time. And because it will take a long, long time to execute, if we make use of that problem as a basis for a crypto system, what that means is it's probably pretty secure. the solution of the problem would be breaking the cryptosystem. But if the problem is very, very hard to break, as the algorithm takes a long, long time, then very likely the cryptosystem is based on that problem for its security is going to be secure.
What's to say that you can't crack these algorithms?
The algorithms that you have to do. I mean, the algorithms themselves work. It's a problem. It's the problem. And is there your question really says, is there a faster algorithm? Is some clever person going to find a faster algorithm that will solve this? And this is something we always worry about, and we can't give an answer to that question. No single mathematically based cryptosystem is certified secure by a mathematical proof. It's not there. We do this sort of by trying as hard as we can to break it. By using clever people to do this, and if they're unsuccessful, we think it's probably pretty secure. But these are things that over time become less secure because discoveries keep being made. Just as a simple example, there's a very commonly used cryptosystem called RSA. And back in 1976, when it was discovered, it was based upon the difficulty of dealing with a number which was 129 digits. Today, that number has to be over 160. So if you're asking people going out hacking by trying to actually solve the problems by creating faster algorithms, I would say probably some people might be interested in that, but most people are looking for vulnerabilities within the operating systems.
If these things can be published and you know that there's a certain pattern to them, is there something else that's set in place to further protect the security?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is called, for the kind of system that I was talking about, the RSA, that's an example of what's called a public key cryptosystem. And when these things are actually used on the computer, there's something that's associated with it called, it's called PKI, public key infrastructure. And there is this, all of the stuff that goes around it. And then there's stuff that goes around that that actually allows the problem to be useful so that people can actually access it without having any idea of what the problem is or anything else. They just say, I want this encrypted and I want it done this way. Press a button and it's done. They never have to know anything.
How did you get interested in this?
Well, that's a good question. And I got interested in this around 1977 when that very cryptosystem I was talking about, RSA, was published. Because what it was the very first number theoretic system that was based upon a hard problem in number theory. I was a computational number theorist, so I found this fascinating that actually some of my work could be useful. Oh, that's great. It's wonderful when you're applying for research grants.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. Hugh Williams, a professor of mathematics at the University of Calgary, and he's the head of the new ICORE Center for Information Security and Cryptography. Also on hand for the launch of CSAC was British science writer Simon Singh. He's the author of a very entertaining history of cryptography called The Code Book.
Cryptography, the science of codes and code breaking, is just naturally interesting. It's has a great history. For centuries, people have had secrets. They've wanted to code those secrets, and other people have wanted to break those codes and figure out what's going on. So it's a great subject with a great history. And I began to realize that it's very relevant today because we live in the information age, and the way you protect information is by encoding it. So today, we use codes more than ever before. If you've got a cell phone, that communication will be encrypted. If you use email, you might encrypt your emails. If you buy stuff online, that might be encrypted. If you have pay TV where you're watching the latest, you know, the big fight on satellite, that may be encrypted. So more and more we have encryption in our everyday lives. And so by writing the code book, what I was trying to do was to write about the history of the subject, which is kind of just racy and exciting, and to draw lessons about where we are today.
Where are we today?
Well, we're in a kind of golden age of cryptography. It's the information age, so information is flowing all over the place, more important information and in greater volume than ever before. And luckily, the codes we have are effectively unbreakable. Now, we can never be complacent. We should never be complacent. So people are always striving to build better codes because code breakers are always trying to break into those codes. But essentially, individuals can have secret communication. Businesses can have secret communication with their clients, confidential communication, governments, the military. I mean, that's all kind of good. You know, you and I, we all want privacy. But it's also good for the terrorists and the criminals. In the past, if you wanted to convict somebody in the mafia, you would tap their phone line and get them effectively to give you a confession. Now you can't tap the phone line of the mafia, or you can tap it, but you wouldn't understand what they were saying because they'd use encryption. And as I've said, the encryption today is effectively unbreakable.
So the key to breaking codes, though, is the key. Judging from your talk, how do keys work?
A key is just your recipe for encryption. So the recipe could be bump every letter up one place. So A becomes B, B becomes C, C becomes D, and so on. In modern encryption, the key is typically a number. So I have a piece of software. That software can encrypt messages in lots and lots of different ways, depending on what number I put in at the beginning. And that's my key. I know that number, and the person receiving the message needs to know that number so they can decode it. The eavesdropper in the middle hopefully doesn't know that number, and there are too many numbers for them to try and work out which number it is. In theory, that's how cryptography should work.
But how do we get these keys back and forth, especially now when you're dealing with sending email messages to anybody all around the world?
Well, for thousands of years, people thought the only way you could get a key from one person to another was by putting it on a motorbike, giving it to a courier, meeting that person a few days before. Now, that's impractical in the information age. There's just too much communication with too many people you've never met before. So there is a system that's been developed in the last quarter of a century. Goes under the broad heading of public key cryptography. Now, what that means is that I publish a recipe for encryption. I say, this is Simon's recipe for encryption. And I give it to the world. I put it on my business card. I might put it in some kind of directory. Anybody who wants to send me a message gets Simon's recipe and scrambles up their message and sends it to me. Now, I can unscramble it because it's my recipe. But the weird thing is that even if you know the scrambling recipe, that won't allow you to unscramble it. So just typically you would think, well, if I know how to scramble it, I can unscramble it. But modern encryption, some modern encryption systems, don't allow that. So I can hand out freely the scrambling algorithm, and that doesn't allow anybody else except me to know the unscrambling algorithm. And that's transformed encryption. It's transformed security. It's transformed the information age. And a lot of that is based on very pure mathematics. Mathematics, some of it was invented hundreds of years ago just for the love of mathematics. But now it's finding very real, very commercial applications.
What do you think is next for cryptography?
I think there are two things. One is I think there needs to be a sort of a broader education so that people realize what they're using, why they're using it, perhaps how it works a bit, so that they're aware of the issues of privacy. And secondly, we need to continue developing better encryption technology, technology which maybe is not just fast, but which is also simple to use, which is powerful, which maybe works on a small chip on a credit card. Also, it's not just privacy. It's a case of, if I send an email, how do you know it's from me? If I send an email, how do I know it arrived? If I send an email, how do I know somebody hasn't changed it? All of those are parts of cryptography which people work on.
When you had your code contest and it was finally broken by the group of Swedish cryptographers, they told you that you had made a mistake. And if you can make a mistake, certainly other people can. What was your mistake?
Oh, my mistake was when I encrypted one of the stages, I just did things in the wrong order. I was just a bit sloppy. And that's an important lesson, that often it's human sloppiness. The encryption is much better today than ever before, but there's more information being sent around the world than ever before by more amateurs than ever before. So that means there's more badly encrypted information also available. So that's the kind of lesson that comes out of that, is don't necessarily just rely on the software. Look at the human angle as well.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Simon Singh, a British science journalist and author of The Code Book. With increasing concern over drought, climate change, shrinking glaciers, and industrial usage, water is fast becoming a huge issue of concern in Alberta. Alberta Ingenuity recently sponsored a very successful conference on watersheds, and this attracted scientists, policymakers, and environmental activists from across the province. And day two of the conference began with the announcement of a $7.5 million initiative, the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Water Research. This pan-Alberta approach to research will involve scientists from the University of Alberta, the University of Calgary, and the University of Lethbridge. One of the center's three co-directors is Dr. Stuart Rood, a professor and water ecologist at the University of Lethbridge.
This is a really exciting development, both for the group of us at the University of Lethbridge and more broadly for our colleagues and friends at the other two research universities. What it will enable us to do is take a step back from the small types of questions and studies that we generally undertake and ask the big interdisciplinary types of questions that will be critical for Alberta's prosperity relative to water.
What is it that you bring to this institute?
I've been involved with water research for two decades, and my own interest particularly relates to how river regulation impacts environmental process. We particularly have studied downstream effects of dams. As we put a dam on a river, we not only impact the zone that's flooded, but the downstream impacts are often much more extensive in terms of distance. The downstream impacts are primarily the result of the pattern of flow regulation and not simply the presence or absence of the dam.
There's so many different aspects to water. The fact that it's there, it's in the environment, and we're also dealing with how people use it. There's political concerns, there's environmental and science agendas to follow. How are things going to work together?
The Alberta Ingenuity Center for Water Research is established from the beginning with the anticipation that we're going to involve a number of overlapping research themes. We're interested in what we do to our watersheds relative to forestry, agriculture, urban development. We're interested in the processes relative to water ecology, the processes in the aquatic and riparian systems, and how both of those influence water safety issues related to microbes or toxins. Now, in addition, the fourth dimension is rather novel, and this is the human dimension. From the beginning, we will involve social scientists in a theme referred to as economics, policy, and risk to weave together with the physical and biological components the human dimension. How do we impact our water and how are we impacted by our water? What are the future prospects and what are the future risks?
You're getting $7.5 million over 5 years. Is that going to be enough?
Clearly, this won't be sufficient to answer the questions that need to be answered. It's a very, very important start, and what it establishes is a framework. We fully expect growth in a number of areas, and if we think about $1.5 million per year, it's a lot of money if we had one researcher, but these questions require teams, extensive teams of researchers, lots of students involved. There are, of course, research expenses. So we look at the Alberta Ingenuity investment as the starting point for something that we believe will grow substantially. The universities, from the beginning, have also made a very major commitment to this initiative. Collectively, the three institutions have committed 10 research chairs. This is an unprecedented allocation. Relative to the research, you have two principal costs. One is people, the other is operation, and the people component will be jointly funded by Alberta Ingenuity and also by the universities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Stuart Rood of the University of Lethbridge, who's now a co-director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Water Research. His colleague, economist Dr. Kurt Klein, will lead the investigation into the social aspects of water science. I asked Kurt what he saw as some of the overriding concerns from a sociological perspective.
Water is a very scarce resource, and it's an important resource throughout Alberta, and particularly in southern Alberta, where we operate normally under quite dry conditions and semi-arid conditions. Since the water use affects a lot of people, it's important that it be used as efficiently as possible and make the best possible use out of it. At the present time, we are really lacking knowledge about how to manage this resource properly. In the past, most of the obstacles we faced we have solved by increasing the supplies of water. This doesn't look to be very possible to continue to do in the future for a number of reasons. What hasn't been done is look at demand management. And in the economics and socioeconomics aspects of this research, we'll be looking at different ways to manage the demand and to see that water goes to its highest value use.
Now, in that regard, that really has a technological fix to it. But one of the problems I foresee is that you have what science is going to find out and tell us, but then you also have the political, social arena to deal with. And quite often, people just don't want to change. How will you look at those sorts of things?
We've seen this in a number of areas involving agriculture, for example, where people's attitudes and affiliations and past practices are difficult to change. However, people generally do make changes when conditions are appropriate. And what we need to do is understand more why people respond the way they do. We need to include such things as analysis of property rights issues and legal restrictions and opportunities, and show people that we can devise solutions that might be superior to those that have been used in the past.
Now, you've talked about this in terms of southern Alberta and agriculture, but within this province, we have a real north-south dichotomy when it comes to water. How are you going to take what you're doing from a southern perspective and start integrating the different views between north and south?
Well, this is a major challenge for us, of course. At this stage, we haven't got to the point where we can illuminate very carefully what our research priorities are going to be and how we're going to conduct this. And one of the first tasks we'll have is dealing with and asking stakeholders throughout the province where our priorities ought to be. One of the key priorities has to be in southern Alberta, where the water use is of most concern, but certainly we don't want to overlook the rest of the province as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Kurt Klein, professor of economics at the University of Lethbridge. A second co-director of the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Water Research is Dr. Ed McCauley, a professor of biological sciences and Canada Research Chair in Population Ecology at the University of Calgary.
There are a whole range of questions. You saw some of them that Stu Root presented in his talk a moment ago. Some of the questions deal with how to establish in-stream flow needs, for example. We saw various speakers in the conference talk about the scarcity of water. Well, if the water is scarce, how do we determine how much water can be removed from the system and yet maintain some sort of ecological functioning of that system? We are very interested in trying to understand the processes, the natural processes that are occurring in the streams and the rivers, so that we can provide more objective answers to that. The question is how much we can take away if we're going to utilize the water. Another interesting area is to try to understand the relationship between surface water and groundwater. You saw in the conference, many people were stressing the role of glacial-fed streams and surface water. While there's also the groundwater and those interactions, which we have to take into account. And in particular, understanding the linkage between surface water quantity and groundwater quantity will also help us understand surface water quality.
What makes Alberta a good place to do this?
Perhaps the many problems that we face. And in addition, the fact that, as Stu talked about in the presentation, we have these natural gradients that exist in the province, both going south to north and going west to east. And several of us have taken advantage of that that natural gradient in trying to probe whether or not our understanding is sufficient to explain how the ecosystems change along those gradients. If we can understand how the ecosystems change, then we might be able to understand or predict how they change in response to further perturbations.
And also, too, the headwaters of many of the rivers are here.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant by the west-to-east gradient. And that gives us the advantage of, as you point out, of being able to follow a quote-unquote pristine meter cubed of water, how it moves across the prairie through the urban landscapes, is influenced by human activity and then influenced by economic activity associated with either agriculture, tourism, other endeavors.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Ed McCauley of the University of Calgary and a second co-director of the new Water Research Center. Of course, funding to establish this new Center for Water Research will come from Alberta Ingenuity. Dr. Bill Bridger is the president and CEO of Alberta Ingenuity.
Well, I think in the long term, what we hope is a couple of things. One is outstanding science of such a quality that it, when communicated to policymakers, to politicians, to lawmakers, will encourage them to base their policies on the best possible information and information that is generated locally for systems that are present here. The long-term availability of water, clean water, surface water, groundwater, sources in the mountains, those problems have been laid out very clearly here. And we need to have long-term solutions, and we want them to be informed by research. The second, and I think in terms of the long-term, the most important output of this center will be exceptionally well-trained people, brilliant young Albertans who will be attracted to research in, as graduate students and postdoctoral fellows in water research, and brilliant non-Albertans who will be attracted to come here from all over the world because of the reputation of the center. And that will be a very, very important long-term outcome.
This is being touted as a pan-Alberta research institute. How's everybody going to work together?
Well, we're very proud of this. I think that this is one of the first times when we've had the researchers and the administrations of the three research universities in the province pulling together on a project, putting their own institutional priorities aside and working for the common good. And the application took a long time to generate because of these complications, but now there's such goodwill among the three universities that we're all standing shoulder to shoulder. And I think it's a model for other things, perhaps others of our centers, but for other developments that are unrelated to Alberta Ingenuity. We've shown that it can be done, and I'm really very proud of these people.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
That was Dr. Bill Bridger, President and CEO of Alberta Ingenuity. I also spoke with co-directors of the new Alberta Ingenuity Center for Water Research, Dr. Stuart Rood and Dr. Ed McCauley, as well as theme leader, Dr. Kurt Klein. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. You can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Capital Region Innovation Center, Alberta Research Council, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Conservation Association, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.